You can open your Bibles to Luke 16. That's going to be the text that we'll be in this morning. And I just want to welcome everybody here. It's good to see all of us gathered together to worship God this morning. And if this is your first time here, I'm very encouraged that you would make the effort to be with a group of people that you've never met. And people always have one kind of expectation for how a church worships and how a church does what it does. And I realize that we don't have the most to offer by terms of worldly entertainment and being flashy in that way. But the thing that we try to focus on is the truth and doing things the way that God says. And so if you're looking for truth, hopefully this is a place that that you'll be satisfied in that way with. When God created mankind, he created Adam by breathing the breath of life into him. And the Bible says that humans are made in God's image. Now, that means a couple different things, but one of the things it certainly means is that we are made with an eternal soul. Every single one of us is going to have a state of consciousness forever. Even when we physically die, we will have a state of consciousness. And the question that we have to consider for ourselves, and the question I have to consider for myself more often than I probably do, is where is my destiny? Where am I going to be when I die? When we look at Luke chapter 16, we get this story called The Rich Man and Lazarus, as often been called, where we get probably the most detailed glimpse into the afterlife out of perhaps any other text in the Bible. Let's go ahead and read this story and see what we can learn from this. Look at Luke chapter 16, verses 19 to 31. I'll read the text and then we'll draw some lessons from it. It says, there was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. And in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his side. And he called out, Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame. But Abraham said, Child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able, and none may cross from there to us. And he said to him, Then I beg you, Father Abraham, to send to my father's house, for I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come into this place of torment. But Abraham said, They have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. And he said, No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent. He said to them, If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead. Now, if you're familiar with this story at all, you're probably familiar with the idea that there's a debate about this story. Is this story a parable, or is it something that literally, like, actually happened? There's some people that say that this is a parable, and a parable is basically like a story that didn't literally happen but portrays spiritual truths. Some people say that this is a parable because if you go to chapter 16, verse 1, look at how Jesus starts a different parable. In Luke 16:1, it says, He also said to the disciples, There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to, and he goes on to say this parable. And this story starts out also by saying there was a rich man. So some people think that this is a parable. On the other hand, in Jesus' parables or the stories that he talks about, in none of his parables does he name anybody. In this story, we have Abraham named, and we have Lazarus named. And there's this dialogue in this spiritual realm going on between these people. So this seems to me that this is a story that actually happened. And so we get some interesting insight into this story about the spiritual realm. For example, in this story, well, think about this problem, first of all. If you were to ask most people where they go when they die, most people would say one of two places. Most people would either say it would be heaven or it would be hell. But there's a problem with that because there's several passages in the Bible that talk about a final judgment day. As if before that final judgment day, people's ultimate destinations, they weren't in those places yet. For example, in Matthew chapter 25, verse 33, this talks about final judgment. Jesus says, and he will place the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. So on final judgment, God's going to round up everybody, and the sheep will be on one side and the goats will be on the other side. And to some people, in Matthew 25, 34 says, then the king will say to those on his right, come you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. So it seems on this final judgment day, there are certain people that haven't fully experienced their heavenly blessing yet. But then on the other hand, the people on the left, and those will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. So if we're anticipating final judgment day to be the time where God settles all accounts, where do we go when we die? There must be some intermediary spot that people go. And this story shows what that place is like. And probably you've seen charts on this. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but this is helpful to think about this scene. In this scene, you get this picture of Hades. That's the realm of the dead, the people who have passed on. And you've got two sides in it. You've got Lazarus who goes to Abraham's side. Abraham was, of course, the father of the Jewish nation. He was highly regarded by the Jewish people. And so Lazarus, being a Jew, goes to Abraham's side and he's comforted. And Jesus would later call this same place paradise, but on the other side, you've got this rich man, and he's all alone. And he's in torment, and he's in flaming fire. Now, this seems to be this intermediary place, and there's this great gulf in between, so that nobody can pass from one side to another. And it seems to me that on Final Judgment Day, if you're in this place, you know you're going to end up in heaven, and it's only going to get better for you. But if you're in this place, on Final Judgment Day, it's only going to get worse for you. And so we learn a couple things just about the afterlife before Final Judgment Day from this story. We learn that there's consciousness. In this story, we have the rich man and Lazarus both having consciousness, either of their comfort or of the torment that they're going through. We also learn that there's recognition in the afterlife. Abraham is being recognized by the rich man. The rich man actually recognizes Lazarus. There's all that kind of thing going on. And then again, finally, there's a sealed destiny. You can't change from one place to another. Once we die, the moment we die, our eternal destiny has been sealed. So there's no second chances after we die. There's no place that we go to where we're purified for some amount of time in some kind of fire, and then eventually we get to heaven. There's no place like that. Now, I say all of that to also say this. This isn't the point of the story. The point of this story is not to diagram these things, though I think that is very helpful. Consider that in this context, going back in Luke chapter 9, Jesus sets his face to go to Jerusalem. And so Luke chapters 10 to 19 talk about Jesus' journey to Jerusalem. And there's various stories from this section in Luke, and this story falls into that section. And all throughout this section, there's a crowd of people following Jesus. And Jesus, if you study his life and you read the things that he said and the things that he did, he never does the thing that you expect him to do. And so people have certain concepts of what kind of people will be saved and what kind of people will be lost. And all throughout this journey to Jerusalem, Jesus is showing that it's completely different from what you think. Because Jesus talks about the people who are moral and really religious, and he says that a lot of them are going to be condemned. But then he goes to the people that you would least expect to be saved. The beggarly people, the people that have no earthly riches, the people who have nothing going for them in this life, and he says those are the ones that are going to be saved. Now look what Jesus says in Luke chapter 16. Look who he says this parable, this story that we're looking at to. Look at verse 14. Luke 16:14, the Pharisees who were lovers of money heard all these things and they ridiculed him. And Jesus said to them, you are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts, for what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. Notice who Jesus is telling this parable to. He's telling it to Pharisees who trusted in their wealth. These are highly religious people. They would have gone to the temple. They would have read their Bibles. They would have gone to the synagogue on Saturdays. But they loved money. And Jesus says to them that the things that man thinks are great are an abomination to God. And then we get into this story. So try to imagine this story. Jesus talks about this rich man, and throughout the whole story, the rich man goes unnamed, but he's described in pretty vivid ways. This rich man wore purple clothing. Now, purple clothing was the color of royalty. That was the kind of clothing that a king would wear. And it also says that he wore fine linen. Linen was one of the most expensive kinds of material that you could wear back then, and people would wear it as underwear. So he has really nice underwear. And some people have said that this guy's clothing alone would have cost about 10 times a normal day's wages for most people in that society. So you get the idea that this guy's really flamboyant and he's really flashy about all the things that he has. But what about his food? What kind of food does he eat? The text says that every day he feasted sumptuously. Now, in that culture, bread was the main course of your meal. That's why Jesus said, I'm the bread of life. In our culture, oftentimes the main course of meal is meat, and then the side item is bread. In that culture, meat was a delicacy. And so I picture this guy every single day. He's got his family over. He has all this, like, the best spread on the table every day. Obviously, this guy didn't do the 2 times a week fasting like other Pharisees or other Jews would have. But that's what he's eating, really good food every day. Do you see anything about his house in this story in verse 20? This guy's got a gate at his house. When Samantha and I lived in Tennessee, we lived in really, really close to the 17th wealthiest county in the world. And you'd drive along some of those roads and some houses had enormous gates telling you you can't come in. And showing you I've got a pretty big house and that's why I don't want you to come here. So this guy, extremely flamboyant and everything like that, but there's a contrast in this story to someone who probably never went into his house. There's a man named Lazarus, and it says, at the gate was laid this man Lazarus. Now, don't miss that the story says that Lazarus had to be laid there. Do you know what that tells us about Lazarus? He's probably crippled. Probably couldn't even walk because people had to carry him to that location. And this man is also described in very vivid terms. It says that he had sores on his body. You ever seen somebody that had sores? Like they've got all the red blotches kind of, and maybe sometimes they bleed a little bit. Like try to picture the sores on this guy. And he doesn't just have a couple sores. The text says that he's covered in sores. Try to imagine his arms. Try to imagine his face and his legs. And so he's laying there at the gate, and then his only companions in the story are dogs. Now, especially in Santee, people love their dogs. Like, we have, like, cuddly, fluffy, nice dogs that people actually even put in their shopping carts at grocery stores, and I don't get that because that's where my food goes. But in that time, these would be street dogs. They would look mangy. They would have the really ugly hair that hasn't been groomed. They would be the kind that would have a bad temper. And so the only companion that Lazarus has are these dogs that are licking his sores. Now, what does this guy want? What does Lazarus want? He desires to be fed from the rich man's table. He longs for the food on the table, and it's not just that he's longing for some delicacies. He's longing because he has a legitimate need. Now, we don't know that Lazarus was ever fed by the rich man. But a lot of people have said that death is the great equalizer. Whatever your situation in life is, we all end up dead. And so in this story, both of these people die, and don't miss this. The text says that the rich man was buried. Do you know what that means? That means that he would have been given a proper burial. You picture people at his funeral, and there's people lamenting. They would have hired wailers to cry for everybody. That's what they did in that culture. And so everybody would have been sad about him dying. But then on the other hand, you've got Lazarus, and the text just says that he died. Probably his body was thrown into the valley of Gehenna or something like that, or the valley of Hinnom, and he was just forgotten about. Now, up to this point, remember that Jesus is talking to Pharisees who loved money. And up to this point, everything that Jesus is saying, can you imagine the reaction that the Pharisees may have had? Oh, such a horrible thing that the rich man died. What a tragedy in our society. But then they also hear that that Lazarus dies, and they go, good. That guy won't be bothering anybody at their gate anymore. Get that guy out of here. Now, when they go to their place in Hades, there's a great reversal that happens. Because you picture this scene, and you have the rich man in this area of torment, and it says that he's looking far off, and he can see that Lazarus went to Abraham's side and is being comforted. Try to picture that. Lazarus being comforted in Abraham's side. I don't know what it was all like in there, but the rich man can clearly see everything that he missed, and he, on the other hand, is far off from Abraham. Far, far off. And he actually has a request. He has a request for Abraham that he would send Lazarus to dip his finger in water and cool his tongue. But he starts out his request by saying, Father Abraham, the rich man does. For the rich man to say, Father Abraham, means that this man was an Israelite. This man was a Jew. This man was religious. He probably knew his Bible pretty well. He would have been the person that if you saw him walking along the street, you would think he's certainly going to be in heaven because he looks so pious. And he's such a good guy. But he's far off from Abraham. And think about the request that he has. When he says, send Lazarus to cool my tongue in my torment, we learn a couple things from that. He's being engulfed in a flame, but it's not destroying him. It's just kind of like constantly there, giving him all kinds of pain. But has this place of torment changed the attitude of the rich man? So far it hasn't, because who's he demanding serve him? Even when he's in this place of torment, he thinks Lazarus ought to serve him. And you'd think that he would learn some things from being in here. But Abraham has a stern response to him, and he says, Child, remember something. Remember that when you were on earth, you had all of your good things. And Lazarus, when he was on earth, he got all of these bad things, and now everything's been reversed. Now, this might seem cruel for Abraham to say that. Because all the rich man wants is he wants to have some water on his tongue. Think about it from Lazarus' perspective, though. All he wanted was some table scraps, and he never got it. This isn't cruel, this is justice. And in addition to that, Abraham goes on to say that there's this giant chasm that we talked about earlier, and nobody can go from one side to another. It's impossible to do that. Your fate's been sealed, rich man. And so the only thing the rich man is left with is some good memories that he had on earth. But the torment is so overwhelming that he can't even smile about that. After he had been there for 1,000 years, he still has forever to go there. The rich man has a second request, though. And the second request considers his family. So this rich man remembers that he's still got 5 brothers on earth, and he wants them to be saved. And so he says, once again, he wants Lazarus to serve him. And he says, send Lazarus to my families so that they'll believe. Once again, the rich man is ordering Lazarus around. And for a second time, Abraham has something very stern to say. He says, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. And I picture, as the rich man is being engulfed in this flame, the kind of desperation that would have been in his voice. And he says, no, Abraham. If somebody raises from the dead and goes and talks to them, they'll surely believe. Go send Lazarus. And Abraham once again is stern. And he says, if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they won't believe even if somebody does rise from the dead. Even if somebody has a resurrection and knocked on their door and said, hey, I rose from the dead, listen up, they still wouldn't listen. You know what's ironic about that? In the Gospels, there's at least two people that are raised from the dead. One of them is named Lazarus in John 11. This is a different Lazarus. And the other one was Jesus. And when Lazarus was raised, people plot to kill Jesus. It didn't change their mind. When people knew that Lazarus had been raised from the dead, they didn't go, oh, wow, a miracle. I better change my view about things. They go, we have to kill Jesus. And when Jesus was resurrected, the Jews came up with this idea that the disciples had stolen the body. Didn't change their mind at all. Now, there's a lot of questions that we might have about this scene. There might be a lot of things that we're wondering about this. This whole story deals with destiny and where we're going to go. Here's a question that I have about this. Why is it that the rich man is in torment, and why is it that Lazarus is in a place of comfort? Is it just because the rich man was rich and all rich people are going to end up in hell one day? That's not the case. Is it because Lazarus was suffering and all people who suffer end up in heaven one day? That's not the case either. There's one major contrast between these two people that I haven't really emphasized yet. One of them is named and the other one isn't. Lazarus is named and the rich man is not named. Now, there's an important reason for that. When we look at the meaning of Lazarus's name, I think we can get some insight into why he was comforted. The name Lazarus means whom God helps. Whom God helps. Do you know what that tells us about Lazarus? It shows us that Lazarus's heart, Lazarus's focus and trust in life was in God. Because God was the one who helped him. Now, that sounds funny because he's got sores on his body. He's paralyzed. He's at a gate. He's not getting fed. Did God really help him? How could he really rely on God when his life was in that kind of horrible situation? Lazarus must have understood something. That his ultimate help doesn't come here. That even when everything else is falling apart around him, he still clung to God because he knew that his ultimate help was to one day be comforted and to be with God forever. There's some people that as soon as their life starts to crumble, they don't think God is helping them. And it gives them reason to think that God's let them down and they're no longer going to follow God. I want you to imagine for a moment that your health was severely affected. Would you still say that God is your help? I want you to imagine for a moment that all of your companions were dogs that licked your sores. Would you still say that God was your help? I want you to imagine that you were laid outside the gate of somebody who claimed to be religious, but was the biggest hypocrite in the world. Would you still say that God was your help? A lot of people leave Christianity because they say that there's too many hypocritical Christians. Here's a hypocritical rich man. And Lazarus still relied on God. So that's why Lazarus was comforted. It's because his help came from God. He relied on God. But what about the rich man? At first glance, the rich man being in torment, if you really look at the story, it might seem too harsh. Because imagine this for a moment. Imagine that you had a poor person laid at your gate. Would you call the cops? Would you get that guy out of there? We would all have done that. I would have done that. We don't read about the rich man committing adultery. We don't read about him murdering anybody. We don't read about him stealing anything. And a lot of people in our culture say, that's the basis of your salvation. If you've done no bad things and you can find people that you're better than, then you're okay. So why is this man in torment? Consider how he's described. He's a rich man, and that means that he's a rich man. Lazarus has a name. But the rich man is just called the rich man. Do you know what this shows us about him? that his help and his confidence and his trust was not in God. It was in his riches. It was in his wealth and in his possessions. Do you notice the last time in the text that he's called the rich man? The last time is when he dies. And from verse 22 on, he's simply called he. He's no longer described as a rich man. And there's something interesting about that. If I put all of my trust in things in this life, in people in this life, in riches in this life, in the praise of men in this life, if I put my hope in this life, do you know what will happen to me when I die? It's all going to be taken away. And so the only thing that's left is nothing. This man's identity was his money. And when his money was taken away, the only thing he could be called was a he. Where's your confidence? Where does your help come from? If somebody was to describe what means the most to you, would they say that it was a person? Would they say that it was wealth? Would they say that it's sports? Would they say that it's recreation? Would they say that it's cars? Would it say that, what would they say? And if something other than God is my identity, it will be stripped away from me one day and I won't even have a name anymore. It's all going to be taken away. When trials come, where do we go for help? When everything else around us is crumbling, what do we rely on? This rich man got to a point where he felt like he could be satisfied apart from God because of all the riches that he had. But all of us are rich in something. What is it for you? That's the reason for the destinies. But there's something else that's interesting to say about this. This scene teaches us something about non-Christian loved ones who pass on, or non-saved loved ones who pass on. There's some people that I've talked to before where they had a family member who passed away and they weren't a Christian. I don't know if you have anybody like that in your life. But I've talked to somebody before, and his mother had passed away several years beforehand, and we were talking about Christianity and becoming a Christian, and he said, there's no way I could ever become a Christian because it would be like slapping my mom in the face. And so he felt like it would be dishonoring his mother if he decided to become a Christian. It would be indicting her. This story is really helpful when it comes to non-Christian loved ones who have passed away and the destiny that they have. I want you to imagine for a moment Lazarus' desire for his family. He desperately wants them to be saved. He wants somebody to go to them and talk to them about their eternal destiny. And I want you to imagine for a moment that somebody did rise from the dead and literally go talk to those family members. Can you imagine if that happened and one of the five brothers said, there's no way I would ever convert and become a Christian because that would be like slapping my brother in the face who died. Lazarus, from his place of torment, is pleading, don't come here, don't come here. You don't want to be in this place that I'm at. Do you want to know the best way to honor somebody who's died in your family who is not a Christian? It's to don't go there. Get your life right with God. Because the thing that they desperately want for you in this moment right now is that you would not end up where they are. There is no better way to honor somebody who has passed on and that you suspect would probably not be right with God than to get right with God because that's what they want for you. Something else that we see about destiny in this story is the adequate warning that the rich man had. What's interesting to consider about the rich man's second request when he wants somebody to be sent to his family is he's basically saying, I and my family have not been given adequate warning about this place of torment. In other words, his attitude to a degree has still not changed. He thinks it's not just that he's there. He doesn't think he was given enough evidence and enough proof that this would have been his eternal destination. Is that true? Was he given adequate warning? Notice really carefully verse 30 again. Look at verse 30. And he said, no, Father Abraham. Just stop there. Abraham in the book of Genesis is called a prophet. He was somebody who was given revelation by God and spoke those things. In this place of torment, what is the rich man's attitude towards a prophet? Even when he's being tormented, he's resisting the prophets. And he's saying, no, you're wrong about that. And that's indicative of how he lived his whole life. He would have gone to the Sabbath. He would have worshipped on the Sabbath every Saturday. And he would have heard sermons. And he would have heard things that would have stepped on his toes. He would have heard things in the old law that talked about being generous to the people who are poor. And evidently, every week he heard that, he went, no, 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 those prophets are wrong. That doesn't have application for my life. That applies to somebody else. I wish that so-and-so was here today, because they would have heard those things. Every time he heard the prophets, no, 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 it doesn't apply to me. Was he given adequate warning? Every week. You have to change your life. You have to live differently. You have to help other people. If you've been blessed in one way, you have to serve in another way. He was given more than adequate warning. But Jesus says in this text that somebody could rise from the dead. And if my heart is such that every week when I hear truth, if I keep resisting it, I could literally see somebody raised from the dead and it wouldn't change my perspective. I wouldn't change my life. Do you know what the proof of that is, by the way? Is that Jesus Christ did rise from the dead. He did have a resurrection. And some of us in this room are still resisting the truth every week. Somebody did rise from the dead, and we've been given more than adequate knowledge. So the issue is not so much, have we seen some spectacular miracle that changes my heart? The issue is, where is my heart right now? There's more than adequate knowledge or evidence to show that the Bible's reliable and that Jesus has risen from the dead. But in our heart of hearts, we sometimes will just keep resisting and resisting and resisting. And all along, we're being given adequate warning about where we'll end up. There's many people in our culture right now celebrating the resurrection of Jesus. Do you want to know the best way to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus? It's to every day repent. And it's to every day reflect on what he did for you. So that one day you can be with him forever. I want to end with one more thought. Spiritually speaking, all of us can be like the rich man. He feasted sumptuously every day. He was clothed in royal attire. The Bible teaches that every Christian reigns with Christ. And that every Christian is feasting on the table of God. You know what's true about me? I am the rich man. You are the rich man. Because spiritually speaking, we are extraordinarily wealthy. Are there Lazaruses around us? They might have nice cars. They might look really nice. They might not have sores. They might have a big bank account. But spiritually speaking, they are the Lazarus in this life. And we are the rich man. Are we reaching out to the Lazaruses around us? There's no better way to honor the resurrection than to serve God in those ways. If there's anything that we can do for you this morning, this is an opportunity to make our lives right with God. If there's anything that we can do, please don't leave here without talking to somebody. If you have any questions about anything that you've seen this morning and how we worship and how we do things, you won't hurt our feelings to ask questions. If there is anything we can do for you, though, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.